defining some terms. If we had time, it'd be kind of neat maybe to go around the room and just term by term say, hey, what do you think that means? And just get a consensus even of the background that each of you have in understanding these three biblical terms. But for the sake of time, we're just going to dig right in. And my aim this morning, to be very clear, is simply to bring clarity to the discussion of what these three words mean. These three words that are the three words that are at times translated hell in our Bible. There's only three words. We will focus on the Old Testament word, the Hebrew word Sheol, and the two words we find in our New Testament, Hades in the Greek, the way we would say it would just be Hades, the English transliteration, and then Gehenna. Hades and Gehenna. I'm going to endeavor to help you understand the background of these terms and how they came to be used and translated in our Bible. And all of this is because I am a firm believer that words actually matter. And beyond that, maybe even more importantly, definitions of words actually matter. To know the meaning of a word is very important when you're trying to understand what God says about something. So if I'm relating to a Mormon this morning and we're using the word Jesus, there's altogether different meanings behind the word Jesus. We need clarity here. Let me illustrate the importance of defining terms with a basic human encounter that any one of us could have this week. Let's say you're shopping in Denton or wherever you do your shopping. I just don't. But let's say you're shopping in Denton and you bump into someone at a bookstore, because if I am shopping, that may be where you find me. And after briefly talking with them in this encounter, you discern that the person is a Muslim. And when the topic of religion is broached, one of the first questions out of their mouths is, so are you a Christian? Well, what do you say in that moment? As a Christian, you could quickly and easily and confidently assert yourself and say, why, yes, I am a Christian. But words matter, dear ones. And I suggest that that is not the best response in this situation. You see, the typical Muslim has quite the database in their mind of what Christianity looks like. They've seen imagery from the Western world, the vast amounts of television and cinematic output that flows out of this nation. And if they are uninformed and have not met other true believers, the Muslim man or woman likely thinks that, number one, nearly all Americans are Christians. And number two, the typical Christian is one who gets drunk on the weekends, is sexually active with multiple partners, immodest, full of vanity, and deeply immoral. Not who you want to be identified with, is it? So the moment you say, yes, I am a Christian, that is what may flood the Muslim's mind. In such cases, it's better to define your term. Saying something like, well, if you mean Christian in the sense of what the Bible teaches about being a follower of Christ, one that has been saved from sin by his death on a cross, one that loves his law and loves the Lord God with all his heart, soul, mind, and strength, then yes, I am a Christian. And now you've gained some ground and given them a more accurate understanding. The point is, words and the meanings of words matter. And that's where we'll pick up this morning. I want to work through a series of three words that deeply affect our current study. It'll give us more of a foundation as we move forward and see what the Old Testament says about hell, what Jesus says about hell, what the apostles say about hell. It'll give us a framework of sorts as we pursue a deeper understanding of this doctrine. So, number one, the first word we will consider together is the Old Testament word Sheol, S-H-E-O-L. This word appears in the Old Testament a total of 65 times. In the King James Version, it is translated hell 31 of those 65 times. Another 31 times, it is translated grave. And then 3 times, it is translated the pit. In the New International Version, the NIV, it is translated grave 55 times, death 6 times, and then various phrases for the remaining translations. The NASB and the ESV maybe took an easier alternative when it came to the word Sheol, and they leave it as it is, just transliterated Sheol. No further help required, except that in the NASB, 34 of those instances of Sheol have the marginal note, the netherworld. This is how the Bibles have attempted to interact with, translate, and best communicate this solo Hebrew word. From the start, I want to emphasize that this word seems to have a rather broad semantic range. And for you young ones, that simply means a broad set of possible meanings. And those possible meanings have to be determined and understood according to the context, all those words that surround the word. Even the etymology or the origin of this word is hard to pinpoint. Have y'all ever seen that in the spelling bees? When the hard word is given and then the little kid that's about to spell it right and amaze everybody, they say, "Can I get the etymology of that word?" And then they'll say, you know, French, Latin, whatever. The etymology of this word is very hard to discover. Some scholars relate it to a verb meaning to ask, inquire, or beg. That seems like a stretch, but that's what they have discovered. Other scholars relate it to a verb meaning to be hollow. So it's not a lot of help to us as to how we got to Sheol in the Hebrew Old Testament. But what is certain among biblical scholars is that this was a relatively common word used by the Jews to assert this one thing, that death is not the end of a human's existence. And now we're getting somewhere. Well, number one, as to how we understand this word, how is it used? What is that range of meanings? Number one, we see in the Old Testament that Sheol refers oftentimes to death or the grave. I want to consider a couple examples of this from the lives of godly kings in our Old Testament. You can turn to Isaiah chapter 38, and I will read verse 10. This is a lament from the lips of King Hezekiah, who was a godly king, but one who had been very fearful of a premature death. And here's what Isaiah records him saying. "I said, in the middle of my days, I must depart. I am consigned to the gates of Sheol for the rest of my years." Now, I will be reading from the ESV. That's what I'm always reading from in the pulpit. And thus, the instances where Sheol is cited in the ESV, it's just going to say Sheol. Your translation may read different. So again, this is a lament from the mouth of King Hezekiah. who is fearful of a premature death. And you may actually recall his tears on this occasion and how he went immediately into the presence of God and cried out to God, pleading with him to extend his days in the earth. And God heard his prayer. And through the prophet Isaiah, God is going to communicate to Hezekiah, I'm giving you 15 more years of life. Well, upon his recovery from this sickness, he then expresses thanksgiving to God for his mercy and intervention. And that is the context of Isaiah 38:10. He's sharing with us this dread and fear over being consigned to the gates of Sheol. So in the context, it seems that Sheol is indicative of death or the grave. Look with me in 1 Kings chapter 2, verse 6. Another godly king that we are familiar with, King David. And here's what David is going to communicate to his son that would follow him as king in Israel. To Solomon, he says, act therefore according to your wisdom, but do not let his, and the his there is Joab, do not let his gray head go down to Sheol in peace. Again, it's a unique situation. David is nearing the end of his days, and to his son, the future king Solomon, he gives this task. I want you, by way of repayment, by way of justice, I want you to seek and destroy Joab. That's what dad tells son. He wants Solomon to find Joab and kill him because Joab was guilty of betrayal and double homicide. Don't let Joab's gray head go down to the Sheol in peace. I think here it's an instance of where Sheol means grave. And some of your translations may translate it that way. So we have Sheol more broadly or generally referencing death or the grave. But there is a second use of the word that we'll consider now. Sheol referring to the place which all people go at the point of death, or generally Sheol as the state of death. One of the clearest examples of this we see in Psalm chapter 89, verse 48, where the psalm writer says, what man can live and never see death? Who can deliver his soul from the power of Sheol? Well, there is some Hebrew parallelism that is employed here. First part of the verse essentially saying the same thing as the second part of the verse, making it evident then that the power of Sheol is the power of death. Who can avoid it or escape it? That's the point of the verse. And it's a rhetorical question, isn't it? No one can. And so here, Sheol has a broad understanding of the state of death, the place where men go when they die. That there is something, some kind of existence beyond the grave. 1 Samuel chapter 2, verse 6 echoes this understanding as well. The Lord kills and brings to life. He brings down to Sheol and raises up. Again, parallelism. The second part of the verse, in a different way, repeating the content of the first part of the verse, strengthening the argumentation. This is another straightforward, I think, example where the Lord killing is equivalent to being brought down to Sheol. The Lord is master over life and death, over raising men up and putting men down in Sheol. So far, Sheol really isn't presenting any features of the realm of the dead, but it is communicating a close association to death and the grave, on one hand, and the realm of the dead, all of the departed, on the other hand. It is not communicating at this point anything involving reward or punishment. It's just communicating death or the state of death. And the reality is that everyone goes there. This is the thinking of the Old Testament. It is a land, according to Job, of deep darkness and shadows. You find that in Job 10:21. C.S. Lewis picks up on this theme of darkness and shadows in his book, The Great Divorce, which I would commend, but I would commend that you read it intelligently and critically. But in the book, he does paint some wonderful pictures with words, and he describes this nether world as the gray town, a colorless existence. And I think that's in line with what Job would have thought in his day. So, on one hand, death in the grave. Secondly, the state of death, the place where all the dead arrive. Thirdly, now we're getting somewhere. There are texts in which Sheol is describing a place of punishment for the wicked. There are those texts as well. Of the wicked, Job says, they spend their days in prosperity, and in peace they go down to Sheol. He's speaking of the wicked in that monologue, Job 21, verse 13. And Job goes on to say in Job 24, verse 19, that Sheol snatches away those who have sinned. Well, now there's a little bit of a change of focus. Again, a wider range of meaning in this single Hebrew word, to where there appears to be a punitive nature, a nature of punishment toward wicked men. Other examples of this we see in Psalm chapter 9, verse 17. The wicked shall return to Sheol. You that are familiar with the King James, the wicked shall return to hell. All the nations that forget God. And so, we see that there is a day of punishment, a future destiny of punishment that awaits the wicked in Sheol. Or of the adulterous woman in Proverbs. We read in Proverbs 5:5 that her feet go down to death, her steps follow the path to Sheol. Those two verses alone present Sheol in the context of warnings to the wicked. The King James in both instances there translates Sheol as hell. Well, this makes it hard then to simply see Sheol in the Old Testament as a reference to the grave alone or death alone or the state of the dead alone. There begins to develop in the case of verses like these the idea of Sheol as being a punitive place where the wicked dead will be. Now, fourthly, and lastly, the word at times refers to a place from which God will deliver his people. And this too is helpful, showing on one hand the punitive nature of the place, and on the other hand, God's gracious deliverance of his people from such a place. I think we see this clearly in Psalm 49, verse 15. Where the psalm writer says, "But God will ransom my soul from the power of Sheol, for he will receive me." From a text like that, we understand Sheol to be a place of confinement for the wicked, and yet a place from which God will ransom or deliver His people. And this is good news. This is Old Testament gospel good news. Yes, the saints in the Old Testament did speak of life with God after death. Nowhere nearly as clearly as we have in the New Testament. But they did recognize this gospel reality, that they would be with God. And that there was a place from which God was rescuing them. Though it was less understood in the days of Moses, or the days of David, or the days of Micah, generally speaking, it was still understood. Hear David in Psalm 17, verse 15, one of my favorite verses in the book of Psalms. As for me, I shall behold your face in righteousness. When I awake, I shall be satisfied with your likeness. That sounds like something the Apostle Paul could have written, doesn't it? David was aware of this future reality that awaited the righteous, the redeemed of God. He was aware of what God was saving him from. Surely, David had insight into future realities and destinies when he wrote Psalm 23, which ends with the words, that I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever. So, the Old Testament saints understood these things in part, and we know that the Bible, after all, is a book of progressive revelation. So as we're working through the Old Testament, there is a little bit more light being shined along the way, and then we come to the New Testament, right? As the years were advancing, so did the revelatory content that God was giving to humanity. The New Testament now is going to shed a great deal more light on this topic. Never contradicting the Old Testament, only making the picture of future destinies, particularly in our study, only making the picture of hell more and more clear. So, let's turn to the second word in our study now. From the Old Testament word, Sheol, to the New Testament Greek word, Hades. Going back to the days of the Septuagint, which is a document dating back to the 2nd and 3rd century B.C., this was the first Greek translation of the Hebrew Old Testament. Hades, 61 out of the 65 times, is what the translators used in place of Sheol. So it is the first cousin or half-brother or nearest kin to Sheol in the Old Testament. This is another word, however, that possesses a difficult etymology or origin. Scholars tie its history to several different words. One word it is connected with gives the idea of something that is hidden or unseen. Another word communicates something gloomy or gruesome. Or hado carries the meaning of all receiving. And so you've got a combination of terms that exist in the realm of the origin of the Greek word hades or Hades. But once again, the context comes alive and helps us to really grasp the individual New Testament usages of this word. And the point here is to show that in the Old Testament, Hades is nearly equivalent, at least 93.8% of the time, to the Old Testament Hebrew word Sheol. Now, Hades appears in our New Testament 10 times. And all of these 10 occurrences are to be found in 4 books of our New Testament: Matthew, Luke, Acts, and Revelation. 10 usages, 4 books. The King James Version always translates Hades as hell. The NIV has a rather unique handling of the word. 5 times, It leaves it untranslated, simply transliterated, and the NIV would read Hades. Then it translates it two times, grave, two times, depths, one time, hell. It's interesting. Once again, the NASB and the ESV shine forth with brilliant ease, and they leave the term untranslated. All of those occasions, and I put a little asterisk by that, I'll come back to that statement in a moment, all of those occasions will simply read Hades. Again, I'm reading from the ESV. That is what you will hear as I cite these New Testament texts. So, when we consider Hades and how the New Testament writers were using the word, it is important to understand what was an increasingly common view held by the Jews in the days when Jesus arrives on the scene. We need to understand the mindset of the first century Jew. Taking the Old Testament data points and the use of the word Sheol, and ultimately God's character and nature toward wicked men, along with other rabbinical teachings, particularly from that intertestamental period, that 400-year gap between the Old Testament and the New Testament, when Jesus arrives on the scene, there was a common view held by the typical Jew of what Sheol actually was. And the view in Jesus' day was that Sheol had two compartments. One section was for the wicked, where they were punished for their sins. And the other section was for the righteous, where they were comforted and joyful. Surprisingly, or maybe not surprisingly, Jesus actually refers to this view in Luke 16. When he tells the story of the rich man and Lazarus. The rich man died, the text tells us, and was carried to Hades. The King James Version would simply read hell there. Where he was tormented and suffering pain. Yet Lazarus died and was carried to paradise, or Abraham's bosom, or Abraham's side, depending on the translation that you read, where he knew comfort and peace. This unique account in Luke chapter 16 shows us that Jesus was well acquainted with the predominant view amongst first century Jews. And I think it's rather remarkable that Jesus doesn't rip that view to shreds, but rather includes it in this fearful account, stating that a man's eternal destiny is sealed while they yet live, and stating that nothing can be done to alter that destiny after death. Jesus utilizes this same imagery in the account of Luke 16. As well as Jesus shows in this parable of the rich man and Lazarus, how radically different the destinies of the wicked and the righteous are. Again, Jesus uses the word Hades there in Luke 16. Another occasion where he uses Hades is found in Matthew chapter 11, verses 23 and 24. This is paralleled as well in Luke's gospel, but I'm going to read the Matthew account. And he says, "And you, Capernaum, will you be exalted to heaven? You will be brought down to Hades." Again, the King James Version there would just say hell. "For if the mighty works done in you had been done in Sodom, it would have remained until this day. But I tell you that it will be more tolerable on the day of judgment for the land of Sodom than for you." Fearful words from the lips of our Savior, condemning, pronouncing essentially a judgment of woe upon Capernaum, an entire city. Once more, In Jesus' words, we see this sharp contrast between two eternal destinies. Heaven on one hand, hell or Hades on the other. In a strong warning to Capernaum, Jesus ties the judgment of the wicked to, quote, being brought down to Hades. Now, for the third and final time, Jesus uses the word Hades. Out of the 10 uses, Jesus owns 4. 2 of them are parallel accounts. It's also in Matthew chapter 16, verse 18. A well-known verse, I think. To Peter and the other apostles, he says, and I tell you, you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it. Pretty familiar with that verse, aren't you? What translation did I just read from? The ESV. And I am confounded by this. Because I made a comment earlier that the ESV and the NASB leave Hades, Hades all the time. Well, the NASB holds true to that. The ESV, in this single instance, decides to translate it hell. For a reason unknown to me, I do not have an explanation for that. The other 9 instances are left as Hades. But the meaning of the word is rather clear. The context, again, dictating the meaning here. The gates of Hades, or the gates of hell, it's representative of the headquarters of evil, the demonic oppression of the enemy. And that power, that evil, ungodly power, will not be able to stop the advances of the gospel or the Christian church. This is a 2,000-year-old promise that God has kept and He will keep till the end of time. Now, that's what Jesus said when He used the word Hades. 2 other New Testament men used the word as well, and that is Peter, the Apostle Peter, and the Apostle John. Peter is recorded in the book of Acts using the word 2 times. The Apostle John takes the rest of the mentions, all located in the book of Revelation. So, Peter, recorded by Luke in Acts, stands up on the day of Pentecost and he preaches to this gathering of thousands. And in the sermon, he makes reference in verses 27 and 31 to Psalm 16:10. Which says, for you will not abandon my soul to Sheol or let your Holy One see corruption. And in 2:27, the book of Acts, it's identical, except Sheol in the Greek translation uses Hades. You will not abandon my soul to Hades or let your Holy One see corruption. Again, a clear link between that Old Testament word and the New Testament word Hades. In this context, I think either the realm of the dead or the place of punishment for the wicked would fit, both in terms of the prophecy from the days of David in Psalm 16 and the actual fulfillment in Jesus' day. God would not abandon his soul or let him see corruption. The final instances now of this word Hades are found in the book of Revelation written by John the Revelator, the Apostle. And the first one we come to is in the first chapter of Revelation, the revelation of Jesus Christ. And we see him pictured, great, mighty, powerful as he is, holding the keys of death and Hades. Again, the King James Version would just say death and hell. We see this in Revelation chapter 1, verses 17 and 18. And it points to the fact that Jesus, the second person of the Godhead, the one who conquered death and the grave, now holds in his hands absolute authority over death and the entire unseen realm beyond death. Jesus reigns. He determines the day of death for all men. That's what it means that he holds the keys of death. Only he determines the day of death. There is no surprise death for Jesus. It also means when we see that he holds the keys of death and Hades, that Jesus and Jesus alone confines men to Hades, and he alone will release them on the day of judgment that we'll read about in Revelation 20 in a few moments. He has all authority over death and Hades. Now turn to Revelation 20. I'll read verses 13 and 14 and try to tie some of this revelation together. And the sea gave up the dead who were in it. Death and Hades gave up the dead who were in them. And they were judged, each one of them, according to what they had done. Then death and Hades were thrown into the lake of fire. This is the second death, the lake of fire. What this text shows us about Hades is that it's a temporal location, an intermediate state. And hopefully those of you that were here during my teaching through that series on heaven would recognize that terminology of intermediate state. Right? We speak of heaven, and commonly we're just speaking of the heaven that is to come to the Christian the moment they die, where they enter into the presence of Jesus Christ. To die is gain to the believer. But that's an intermediate state. That is not the final and, quote, eternal state of the new heavens and new earth. It's an intermediate state. Well, the same, apparently according to Scripture, exists for the wicked. Upon death, they immediately go to Hades. But they will not dwell there forever. For the dead and Hades will be called to give account before that great white throne, and then they will be cast in to that eternal lake of fire, which burns forever and ever. An intermediate state. That is the thrust of the 10 uses in our New Testament of Hades. Now we come to the third term, the last term. A term that is translated hell in every instance, in nearly every translation. This is the word Gehenna. And this word offers us really the greatest degree of clarity when it comes to the doctrine of hell. I also understand this word to be the most fearful word that we will look at this morning together. And this word actually does have a clear origin story. Because Gehenna in the Greek simply means Valley of Hinnom, which is an actual place we read about in our Old Testament. So we have to look back now, approximately 2,700 years, to the days of the kings of Israel. And there were two wicked kings, one by the name of Ahaz and one by the name of Manasseh, who were guilty of burning their own sons on an altar as an offering to Molech and Baal. that's about as low as you can go. And they did this in the valley of Hinnom. Jeremiah makes this very clear. When he begins to preach as the God-called prophet he was, and rebuke and expose Israel's idolatry, this valley, the valley of Hinnom, becomes the metaphorical point of reference for the place where the wicked would be confined and tortured in fire. I think we begin to see this in Jeremiah chapter 7. I'll read just three verses, verses 30 through 32. And I want you to see how the prophet uses the picture of this particular valley. He says, "For the sons of Judah..." Oh yeah, by the way, Ahaz and Manasseh were kings of Judah, not Israel. "For the sons of Judah have done evil in my sight, declares the Lord. They have set their detestable things in the house that is called by my name to defile it. And they have built the high places of Topheth, which is in the valley of the son of Hinnom, to burn their sons and daughters in the fire, which I did not command, nor did it come into my mind. Therefore, behold, the days are coming, declares the Lord, when it will no more be called Topheth, or the valley of the son of Hinnom, but the valley of slaughter. For they will bury in Topheth, because there is no room elsewhere." Turn again to Jeremiah 32, verse 35. For the sake of time, I'm skipping over another significant reference to this in Jeremiah 19. Jeremiah 32, 35. "They built the high places of Baal in the valley of the son of Hinnom, to offer up their sons and daughters to Molech, though I did not command them, nor did it enter into my mind, that they should do this abomination to cause Judah to sin." So this valley of Hinnom is the epitome in the Jewish mind of wickedness, death, fire, and evil because of what these wicked kings pursued in that valley. And thus it would serve in the prophet Jeremiah's ministry as a fitting analogy describing how God would punish the wicked in hell. Now, sadly, there is some confusion that is rather prevalent in our day about Gehenna, the valley of Hinnom. The common explanation for the origin of this word points to that same valley of Hinnom in the Old Testament, but the picture painted is quite different. The story is told of the valley of Hinnom being a garbage dump utilized by Jerusalem. The once center of idolatry and fiery sacrifice was turned into a town dump of Jerusalem, where trash and eventually dead bodies of animals and men were discarded. This is given as the background of Jesus' words when he spoke of the place where the worm does not die and the fire is not quenched. That in this garbage dump of the valley of Hinnom, the fires never ceased to burn the trash and the decaying bodies, and the worms had plenty to feast upon. Well, that all sounds pretty good. Even seems to give credence to things that Jesus would say, like in Mark 9, about hell. But it isn't true. There is no evidence that before the time of Christ, the valley of Hinnom was ever a garbage dump. The archaeological evidence of this would be rich if the valley had been a garbage dump, and there is no archaeological evidence that says such. It just doesn't exist. In fact, the first written documentation describing the Valley of Hinnom as a garbage dump was from the pen of a European Jewish rabbi, David Kimhi, from a commentary he wrote around the year 1200 AD. That's well over 1,000 years after the ascension of Christ. And here is what he wrote of Gehenna. Quote, "Gehenna is a repugnant place into which filth and cadavers are thrown, and in which fires perpetually burn in order to consume the filth and bones, on which account, by analogy, the judgment of the wicked is called Gehenna." And from that, now, over 800 years later, we have what is a fictional teaching pervading the church as to the nature and history of the word Gehenna. So, a medieval period rabbi writing in Europe suggested this around the year 1200, but it is fictional, not factual. It is certainly not something that would have entered into the mind of Christ or his apostles in their day. It is not rooted in historical fact. So, when you think of the word Gehenna in the coming weeks and years, do not envision a garbage dump with smoldering fires, but rather envision what the Old Testament says as a place of gross idolatry, of burning suns on altars of death. That's the analogy the Bible provides. Think of the radical wickedness that will one day be shut down by God and punished in a place called hell forever. The Greek word Gehenna carries that analogy as part of its meaning. Now, the word appears a total of 12 times in the New Testament. The King James, NIV, ESV, NASB, translate this word hell all 12 times. Of the three words that we have considered, Gehenna certainly brings us the most vivid picture of the reality of eternal punishment. That's beyond debate. Another surprising feature of this word that may shock you is that 11 out of those 12 uses come from the lips of Jesus Christ. Listen with me to what Jesus says when he uses the word Gehenna. He speaks of whole bodies being, quote, thrown into hell. Matthew 5:29, the Sermon on the Mount. He speaks of those being thrown into the hell of fire. Matthew 18:9. He speaks of hypocrites being sentenced to hell. Matthew 23:33. To his own disciples, when he sends them out on their first mission, two by two, he warns them, "Do not fear those who kill the body but cannot kill the soul. Rather, fear him who can destroy both body and soul in hell." Matthew 10:28. He spoke of hell as being a place of unquenchable fire. Mark 9:43. And a place where the worm does not die. Mark 9:48. Jesus was very clear on his teachings about hell. He is very clear that there is a fate far worse than death that awaits the wicked. In the mind of our Savior, there is a place of everlasting punishment involving both the souls and bodies of wicked men. And in the coming studies, we will consider these details more closely. For now, I hope each of you have a little bit more clarity on these three words in your Bible that are at times, or in the case of Gehenna, always translated hell. May the Lord help us in our weakness and give us understanding. That concludes the Bible study this morning.